maybe preclude an appeal from even being necessary.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's the object.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out that as my reference to administrative agencies is, under the Administrative Procedures Act, a state agency can retrieve its order, correct it, reissue it, and perhaps make this correction. So I think what this is intending to do is to give the trial courts a similar sort of power, and which is helpful to cutting down on litigation. And I'm just saying that as my understanding, because we haven't had anybody.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Representative Clark.
This needs to happen. One point of personal experience, we had a case last year where I actually had to file an appeal simply to toll a statute of limitations on an appeal. Meanwhile, there was substantial work that needed to happen at the trial court, so we were filing motions simultaneously in the trial court and in the appellate court because we were unclear as to who had jurisdiction to fix the technical problems that happened at the trial court, but we couldn't let the time continue to run on the appeal. And so it was literally absurd.
It's a great motion, Representative
Innes.
It should carry. is there further discussion? Representative Edmondson?
I just called
the question. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Vaughn?
Yeah.
Calhoun?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Edmondson?
Yeah.
Representative Innes?
Yes.
Chair Bowman?
Yes. Motion carries. I think that leaves us with House Bill 2764, if I'm correct here. Chair would move to amend House Bill 2764 at line 16 to replace the word clerk with the word plaintiff. That's moving the adoption of the amendment as proposed by the Oregon Judicial Department, dated March 20th, 1989. Is there any objection? Is there any discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Move House Bill 2764 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
I appreciate Representative Minnis pointing out to me that all of my trouble with this bill was actually trouble with the existing law. And coming out of Arkansas, one of the things you learned is you don't pick a fight where there is none. And so I'm just happy.
I wanted to say that you're the second attorney who's made that confession
backed
so far
today.
Today.
That's right.
And it seems quite noble. I appreciate it. Is there any other discussion? Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Minnis?
Aye.
Bennett?
Aye.
Edmondson?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Calhoun?
Aye.
Baum?
Yes.
Chair Bowman?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you very much. That completes our agenda. Meeting is adjourned. Representative Mannix.
I ask unanimous consent that I be permitted to cast a vote on 2599, House Bill.
There's no objection. What is your vote?
I vote aye.
Representative Baum. Would you like to cast your vote on Senate Bill 74, Representative Baum? We pass that to full committee. Representative Baum votes aye on Senate Bill 74. Representative Calhoun.
Since we're in the Senate,
Representative Calhoun votes aye on Senate Bill 74. Representative Clark?
No, we blew through that one so quickly that I don't remember voting on it, but I believe that I did.
You did. Meeting is adjourned.
Judy.
It's not adequate to handle these sorts of problems. What we are proposing here is not to create law, but to take existing law in the main, take existing law and codify it, existing case law, and codify it, and make it possible that people who, like us, can ensure that we can get justice. Case law is not enough. It can be changed by any court any time. If it's codified, then at least it's a little more difficult. Also, people can look at the law. Common citizens ought to be able to look at the law and determine what their rights are, pretty close at least. And at least they can go to a lawyer. And they can decide whether they want to pursue remedies of some sort or another. The law, there's no explicit statutory law. At least we couldn't find any, and there were lawyers who were friends who went, used the computers and so on, could not find any evidence in Oregon. There's a statute of frauds in Oregon. People of my generation grew up believing that a man's word is his bond. In fact, I was told over and over again when I was a youngster, I recall that a verbal contract is as good as a written contract. The neighbor says, don't worry, we'll pay our share. We'll pay our fair share. But those are meaningless under the statute of frauds. And people of my generation can be sucked in on that type of thing. Another thing that helps people who will come in and exploit and stonewall is the provision or interpretation of Oregon law which prohibits the recovery of costs by prevailing parties in litigation over private road maintenance unless there's some, as I understand it in Oregon, unless there's something specifically in a law that says that that the prevailing party can recover. In our case, it costs $3,500 to fix the road. It costs at least $3,500 to go to court. So we had no alternative. We couldn't afford either one, actually, after we were retired. The proposal we have made is based, then, on existing law. Case law in Oregon, as discussed in the volume on real property published by the state, by the Oregon State Bar in 1975 and supplemented in 1985, and on California Civil Code 845 as amended. I can go through each of the provisions, if you like, and try to explain where we got those particular provisions and why we included it. We added, and you again use as much as possible existing case law in Oregon, added Section 5 with guidelines for courts and or arbitrators, which might help if the parties on a private road were to look at the law, might help them in drawing up a private agreement among themselves or determining what their rights were and so on, and avoid litigation. If it did go to litigation and an arbitrator were appointed, the court were to take it over, then one of the things that it seemed to us would be helpful would be to have guidelines so that pretty much the same sort of law would be applied depending on the circumstances wherever the issues came up.
Mr. Ockert, I'm sorry, it's Ockert, isn't it? A couple of things. I was hoping that Representative Peterson would be able to be here.
So
and
was I.
She's. Well, she is chairing another committee downstairs, and I'm sure that she'd be on her way, and we've sent notice. She did let me know that you were on your way, so in a sense, she's lending her support. The feeling that I'm getting from the members of the subcommittee is that they would like to acknowledge what it is that you've brought us today by going into a work session. Now, Representative Peterson, do you want to come up? We were just talking about you.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was just so enthralled in what I was doing in my subcommittee. Thank you, Chair Bauman. I am State Representative Nancy Peterson, District 52, and I may be here after the fact. It looks like Mr. Ockert has already begun. I would like to just say that he contacted me about a year ago, began describing this problem, and my response was, oh, you're kidding me. Certainly there's something out there in law that deals with this. And came to find that out that indeed there was nothing, that it's based primarily on case law, and lots of people are left out there hanging, whether they're small woodlot owners or small farmers or senior citizens or whatever, and it seems to me it's a problem we should address. So I don't want to get into the technicalities of it. I think Mr. Ockert will, but I'm here because I definitely think it's a problem and we should deal with it.
Well, I appreciate that. And what I'd like to do, Mr. Ockert, if you can assist us at this stage, is take us into work session on House Bill 2529 and first ask if I can invite a motion from the subcommittee. Representative Clark.
Move to the floor, or full committee with due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Clark moves House Bill 2529 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Baum.
Just to clarify some confusion on my part, has this bill been amended in any way, or is it the regular bill we've just...
It has not been amended. Would you like to propose an amendment, Representative Baum?
No. I assume we must have had a previous public hearing on this when I wasn't around.
No.
I think it's a good bill, and I'm one of the co-sponsors on it, but I've received some fairly...
That would be the desire of the chair, Representative Baum, and as we've seen with other bills, when issues arise that are subsequent to the public noticed hearing date on the bill, occasionally we will pull a bill for another hearing.
That's fine. I'll
Madam Chair.
Representative Edmondson.
I'm just assuming that there were no other witnesses signed up for this.
There are no other witnesses signed up. I wouldn't. I wouldn't do this.
I want to make that clear that if there had been objections, I'm just checking my bill file. And I haven't received any, and this was notice. Assume those were so serious objections that we would have heard something about.
That's my concern as well. This isn't a major issue in House District 13, but.
Madam Chair.
Representative Minnis.
Real quick question. Nancy, when you had this bill put together, Legislative Council, did they do some research for you on the case law?
Actually, they sure did. Mr. Okert himself has done a fair amount of research and looked into California law, and we brought all that to legislative research, and they spent a fair amount of time looking at it to be sure it fit in with what Oregon already had or didn't have, and I feel quite comfortable with that.
I just wanted to make sure for the record that we understood that there was a significant amount of analysis that's already occurred in this bill. So.
Excellent written presentation.
Yes, thank you for your written testimony, Mr. Okert. Other questions? Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Baum?
Yes.
Calhoun?
Yes.
Clark?
Aye.
Edmondson?
Yes.
Mannix?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Minnis?
Aye.
Chair Robinson?
Aye. Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to compliment the committee. Sitting in committee myself, where it takes weeks and sometimes months to pass one bill, I'm amazed and impressed. I thank
you
all.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mannix.
There are a couple of technical
scrivener's
corrections that need to be done that Representative Baum is aware of. I didn't want to slow down the proceedings by bringing that up.
Thank you. We will make sure that's done between now and the full committee. We'll open public hearing on House Bill 2764. Mary Beth Raymond.
What are these three horses?
Yeah,
in the
right. Can we really? We've got this group over here. Come. I think we better call on Keith Burns. With all due respect, I realize that I don't know. Representative Saylor and Representative Miller, you aren't signed up. It's a courtesy that I generally would extend to Mr. Burns, even without you.
Madam Chair, we deeply care about this bill.
Madam Chair, and
maybe you can tell us why.
Members of the committee, my name is Keith Burns. I represent the Oregon Financial Services Association. This bill merely does, with respect to service of summons, what can be done in the circuit court. That is, it allows the service of summons, all service of summons in the small claims to be served by certified mail. As you can see, looking at lines 10, 11, and 12, it was the intent of the legislature that that be true. that to be able to serve it the same way as you could in a circuit court. However, the circuit court gets its directions from service from the civil proceedings sections, and they do not apply to any court other than the circuit court unless they specifically say so. And that is why this bill is before you, so that we specifically say here that all summons in the small claims court can be served by certified mail. This doesn't mean to say they all will be. In fact, very few of them will be. But many times, for instance, the members of my association, or this association I represent, oftentimes merely want to get people's attention to get them in so they can work out a course of payments and so forth and rescue the loan on small loans that they may have. And they don't hear from them, they do it in this way. Other times they want to find out if a person is even living where they lived before, and they do this rather than to invest the amount of having personal service. If it's a large amount, the members of this association, as with collectors and everybody else, will continue to use personal service because they don't want to take the risk of somebody coming in and say, that's not my signature or something of that nature. So it's really a thing that they'll use more as an exploratory, a thing to get people in to try to get them back in good status as far as their loan's concerned. And by having this means of doing it at less cost, they're more likely to do it rather than go ahead at personal service. Once they got that investment, go ahead to a trial and suit against their borrowers. That's history of this, and I am honored to have such fine people here sponsoring this bill on behalf of the Oregon Financial Services Association.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Are there questions? Would you like to add a comment, Representative Saylor?
I hadn't planned to, Madam Chair. However, I will just say that in the last legislative session, 1987, I sponsored a bill that raised the amount of that can be adjudicated in small claims court, and this seems to fit in with that in lowering costs, giving citizens access to the system.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
I'd like to ask any one of the three of you to answer this. We do have some testimony that will be coming in from the Marion County Sheriff's Office, which says that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association does not support the bill, and it's very short. I want you to be aware of this, and I'd like your reaction. They say that they're concerned that defendants will not receive adequate notice. They also mention a mildly negative fiscal impact on counties. Obviously, we've not been overwhelmed by fiscal impact discussions of late, so maybe we'll slide by that one for a moment. I only say that in jest, Madam Chairman. They say more serious than the fiscal impact is the probability that defendants will not be notified and have judgments filed against them without their knowledge and with no opportunity to defend themselves. Could you react to that, please?
I may. I would assume that the sheriff's office is clear there that they are serving summons processes. Historically, whenever a public body has such people on the payroll, they do oppose this. They see it as maybe a reduction of their job being eliminated, and that's been my history in observing this in Multnomah County, where they served a lot of summons and that. They always opposed this type of legislation for that reason. As I indicated, nobody's going to go to court on a certified mail service on large amounts to have that type of thing being argued that they aren't served. It'll be used primarily by people out there with very small claims who would have to put the money for the service up in front, and it would be used by people who could afford that personal service, such as the members of the association I represent, but who really want to bring the people in to get them back on track on paying their amounts that are owed, or if it's a small amount, to do it this way, which is less expensive. Now, it's true, they can't always recover the cost of personal service, but they may not be recovering anything anyway out of it, and that would just be that much more money. That's my reaction to it, and like I say, certified mail, signed receipt would be the evidence. On large items, they are not going to take that risk of having somebody come and say, I didn't sign that, and things of that nature.
May I have one further question?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
Thank you. This is also self-limiting anyway, in that it applies only to small claims.
That's correct. Well, in the circuit court, you can do it right now. But this, as far as the extension is concerned, it's very limiting. It's only small claims.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Edmondson.
Mr. Burns, I just want to make sure I understand this bill. It's not simply a mailbox type rule where you drop it in the postal box and that's service. The receipt is required here. And as I'm reading on the front, on the page one, that you must have a return receipt that is evidence that the notice was served. So we really do have, there's evidence that it was an actual receipt is required here, and it's not just simply posting it that makes
certified mail.
Yes. Now, just to follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
If the defendant did not actually receive the notice, would it be your understanding that would be grounds to seek relief from default if they don't appear?
That would be true even with personal service. If somebody came in and filed an affidavit and said they personally served and they came in, it could show that they served the wrong person. It would be the same thing.
Okay. I just want to make that very clear here. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Miller, did you want to make a statement?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just here to lend my support to the bill and help Mr. Burns answer any highly technical questions.
Yes, I'm concerned about Mr. Burns' reputation,
technical,
actually.
I would have needed
this. Thanks to the committee.
Thank you. Oh, excuse me, before you leave, Representative Calhoun.
Just for purposes of this part, Mr. Burns, for purposes of speeding it up, there's some proposed amendments from the...
No objection to that.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Mary Beth Raymond.
Madam Chair, my name is Mary Beth Raymond, and I am the president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers. We have appeared before this committee numerous times this year. I once again appear on House Bill 2764 with some real questions. First of all, 2764 asks that the clerk mail the copy. Each courthouse will then have to hire a new clerk. They will have to fill out the paperwork.
I'd like to interrupt, if I may.
Representative Mannix.
We're going to save a little bit of your testimony because I think that was a very legitimate concern, and there's already an amendment that's been proposed by the Judicial Department to change clerk to plaintiff, because that would be a very bad problem if we didn't do that. I don't think anyone on this committee is going to say it should be the clerk who mails the notice. Maybe I'm being out of... I'm just trying to save a few
minutes on that. No, I appreciate
that,
Representative
point.
Mannix. Do you have testimony on any other points of the bill, Ms. Raymond? Go ahead, then.
They're going to mail these... And as I just heard in the testimony before, to find out a few things, they're going to mail the small amount ones because they want them to come in and settle the bill. Why don't they just call them ahead of time and avoid the rigmarole altogether? Just call them up and say, hey, you know, before we do this step, why don't you come in and work on something? It seems that would be time-saving also, rather than mail them a letter. As you know, of you who receive certified mail, you have the right to go in and see where it's from, who it's from. You don't have to accept it. The other thing is they said they wanted to use it to find out if the person was still there. That's very simple. All you need to do is send an ACR, an address correction required. Costs you 25 cents to find out if they're still there or not. Seems like 25 cents is a lot better than $3.75 to send a certified mail that they're probably not going to sign for anyway, especially if it's going to be in the plaintiff's envelope that says it's from beneficial or et cetera. I wouldn't if I knew I owed them money. I mean, if they defaulted on the loan, that seems kind of silly. Last but not least, it does take away from the sheriffs and the private process servers. It takes away business of serving these people personally. A personal service is a lot better than sending something certified mail. As we all know, lots of people in America, you can't read their own writing, let alone somebody else read their writing. True, it's supposed to say to addressee only. Well, that's great, except the mailman comes to the door and says, are you so-and-so, so-and-so's out of town? You say, sure, what the heck? It's happened to me. It could happen to anybody. He's going to go to court and say, I never got it. I would like to see 2764 not get out of committee. My other question is, they say that basically they're going to do this for small amounts. They can do it for $50 or less now. They say large amounts, they're not going to do it. Then why are they introducing the bill at all?
Thank you. I do understand clearly that you oppose the bill. Ms. Raymond, are there questions?
Thank you very much for your time.
Mary Powell.
My name is Mary Powell, and I'm from Carlton, Oregon. And this past summer, I've had numerous certified letters from SAFE, as I'm disabled. And the post office got so they was just shoving them in my box, not asking me to come and get them, and they would be there with a little card on the back. Well, if I got a small claims in this manner, I'd pitch the whole thing in the wastebasket, wouldn't you?
Well, let me see if I can take care of this. One of the items in the bill, in addition to requiring that there be a return receipt that you've signed, and if you threw it in the garbage, there would be no notice, and the service wouldn't be perfected, and whoever was suing you would have to go through another process. I think we're protected on that in the bill. The other notice is that the envelope is going to be marked with words, deliver to addressee only, which might change the procedure a little bit from what you experienced during the summer. I don't want to cut you off, but I do want to ask if you can testify to any other problems that you see with the bill. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way to testify today.
They stuff the box. They don't.
Can't sign a receipt unless you've signed a receipt, ma'am. This requires that you sign a receipt.
Representative Mannix, thank you. We have one more witness signed up on the bill, Bill Linden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. The Judicial Department doesn't have a position on this bill, but we have offered an amendment that would relieve a potentially large workload impact that the bill as originally drafted would have, and that has been referred to by Representative Calhoun and Representative Mannix to, in line 16 of the bill, replace the word clerk with the word plaintiff. Right now, we do a handful of service on cases under $50. As the bill was originally drafted, we would have potentially over 90,000 cases in which we could be asked to do that service, and that would have had a fiscal impact. So I would recommend our amendments to you, and we have discussed these with the proponents of the bill, and they're agreeable to making that substitution.
Thank you, Mr. Linden. Any questions? Questions on the amendment? Are there any other witnesses to testify on House Bill 2764?
Madam Chair?
Yes, for
Representative Clark. I have two questions for Mr. Burns, if we could get him back up here.
Mr. Burns.
That wouldn't be too much trouble.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. I see no provision in the bill for the plaintiff to certify to the court how he or she has accomplished service. Can I assume that normal, believe it or not, I have never been in small claims court at all.
You can't be as an attorney.
Well, I understand that. Can I assume that there is some requirement that an affidavit of service is submitted to the court?
I think that's covered. You start there, line 19.
Okay, now I read line 19 and 20 as being evidence of the date of service, not of the fact of service or the manner of service.
I
I'm looking for is someplace in the bill where it tells the plaintiff what the plaintiff has to do to tell the court, for the court's files, what happened to service.
May be relying upon civil procedure code. It does say in the same manner as in the circuit court elsewhere, but the reason why that hasn't applied is that only applies to circuit court proceedings, other than circuit court proceedings, if it's so stated, and it is not there. So they may have been relying on that. If any amendment to accomplish that is there, but the first thing a judge is going to do is to look to see that there was service, and ordinarily, as you know, you have an affidavit there, and you put down the return receipt. On your affidavit showing it had been done. Right. Otherwise, the court wouldn't even have jurisdiction.
Right, and that's
so
why
I think it would be a natural process, but if you felt more secure in having language there, we certainly wouldn't have any.
I sure would. And the second thing, Madam Chair, if I could follow.
Yes, Representative Clark, go ahead.
Line 21, or 20 through 22, actually, if service by certified mail is not successfully accomplished,
of witness and the ability to reconstruct the events. At the same time, I don't see a wholesale filing of lawsuits simply because of the tolling without the careful assessment to be sure that the price to be paid by the victim is really going to be justified by the outcome of the case.
I have another question.
Representative Minnis.
Just following that up, the flip side of that would be an allegation of the sort that we've heard today would be somewhat catastrophic on the life of the individual who's the alleged abuser also. And if the evidence is borderline and the alleged violator is someone of some personal wealth or substance, I mean, I guess I could see an attorney evaluating their case and making a decision, not necessarily based on the quality of the evidence, how clear-cut that is, but if they've got a reasonable case, it looks okay, but may or may not fly kind of a decision, and yet the person has some substance to their personal wealth, it's a case worth going after and then subsequently making a decision based on that. And I'm thinking of the reputation of the person who's going to be attacked in court. Under those circumstances, and I'm all for hanging people, I mean literally hanging people who are involved in molesting children.
Just bad people. Yeah. Just bad people.
Preferably. In any event, I'm not going to get into a summary execution kind of a dissertation, but...
Thank you, Representative Minnis. Are we at the question part yet?
We're sort of there. Okay. I guess the question, if I hadn't been interrupted, I'd been there a little bit earlier. I guess the question is, don't we have to take into consideration in looking at the quality of evidence, the kind of charge that's going to be lodged against an individual, and whether or not, in the determination that that person's defense attorney or plaintiff or, what is it, respondent's attorney is going to make in settling a claim, that in fact my client may have a significant amount to lose, and it may be more reasonable for you to settle this thing now outside of the court rather than taking this thing to trial. I guess I'm looking at it from both sides. It's one thing to come in here to talk about child abuse and child molestation, so on and so forth. It's the other thing to talk about how these people are affected when they're subsequently charged. And I guess if we're looking at these kind of lawsuits that's ever been extended, I want to make sure that the quality of the evidence is the best you can possibly have. Anyway, there's my statement. I don't know if you can respond to it or not, because everybody else has figured out the answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Minnis, I really do appreciate the concerns that you've expressed, and I say that as from the perspective of what I hope is a conscientious practitioner, and I think most of my colleagues are conscientious practitioners. And in evaluating a case, we have a duty to protect the interests of our client, and I just would like to reiterate that protecting the interests of our client often involves making the hard decision to tell someone that this is not a case that they should be bringing, because if they do not have a case that appears to be winnable, it doesn't matter how much financial wealth may be on the other side. That only tells me that financial wealth is there to aggressively defend the case and to drag it out and to make it as hard as possible on my client. And I would want to be sure that we could win it, not just looking at whether or not the resources were there to pay an ultimate judgment. And I believe that would be the response of any conscientious practitioner before engaging in the incredibly time-consuming, expensive, and emotionally draining litigation that this type of action requires. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
I have a technical question.
Representative Mannix.
What would the actual time limitation had been in this case?
Andrea was abused when she was 16 and 17. There is a 2-year statute of limitations for personal injuries. Presumably, her own period of ability to bring this action did toll at age 19 because of the current law. Whereas if you look at the first events of abuse that happened to her at 16, the 2-year period of limitation would take her until age 18, but for the tolling, which would give her until age 19.
As I understand the current law, for a child, any cause of action tolls till the age of 18. It's a child under disability, isn't it? If at the time the cause of action accrues, any person entitled to bring an action mentioned, well, it's only for 10 to 50 and 70 to 250, I think that covers just about everything, is within the age of 18 years, then it says the time of such disability shall not be a part of the time limited for the commencement of the action, but the period within which the action shall be brought shall not be extended more than 5 years by any such disability, nor than 1 year longer than after such disability ceases. I'm trying to read this and figure it out. How does the chronology fit here?
Madam Chair, if I may respond by using some numbers, Representative Mannix. I think of this better when I'm thinking in terms of ages. If you have a 10-year-old injured, 2-year statute of limitations plus 5-year tolling.
All right.
Two years plus five. It doesn't begin at 18.
That's
correct.
All right.
Their rights end at age 17. It does not matter that they've yet reached the age of majority. I cited in my written material reports from New York and other states which do not even begin running the statute of limitations until the age of majority has been reached.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Calhoun.
I had a comment. Unfortunately, some of the members I think that might maybe could benefit from it aren't here. What the thing we kind of obliquely referred to earlier was start contemplating a jury who decides that the person committed a tortious act, who decides to take money from that person to make the child whole, all of a sudden it's, oh my God, what about the person's rights? We can't have the money taken away. A situation where the evidence might not be the best evidence we could possibly have gotten because of the time of it. So I'm having a real hard time figuring out realistically the consistency in this committee's analysis. Showing a willingness in the past to open these types of things up, so I would expect you to be able to work something out with you if there's a problem or some problems with this building.
Madam Chair, I just would like to be available as a resource if there is anything that needs further research or
thank you, Ms. Snyder. Appreciate your comments, Representative Calhoun. Other questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much. Diana Godwin. Good afternoon. Go ahead.
Hi. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Diana Godwin. I'm representing the Oregon Psychological Association today on behalf of this bill and in support of this bill. Several of our members, in particular Dr. Laura Sebastian and Dr. Meg Eastman, who have appeared before this committee in child abuse cases, in particular on House Bill 2367, dealing with hearsay evidence, both of those psychologists treat victims of physical and sexual abuse, particularly young victims of physical and sexual abuse. They regret that neither one of them was able to be here today, but they did want to lend their support to the idea of extending within a reasonable period the statute of limitations to allow the victims that they treat to have be able to bring a case and perhaps reach some sort of mitigation of their damages and get some closure on their physical and sexual and emotional injuries caused by a defendant, and to preclude these people who have suffered and who may, through therapy, finally reach a point where they may be able to follow through with litigation and then have them cut off arbitrarily by statute of limitations concerns the psychologists who treat these people. And I know that Dr. Sebastian and Dr. Eastman would be glad to be available to your counsel and to the committee as this bill moves through for further support. They just asked me to appear on their behalf today. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Godwin? Thank you. We have Tom Cooney signed up, and counsel just went outside to see if he could round up Mr. Cooney. What we're going to do is take a 10-minute recess, or we will recess until 25 minutes to 4. We're in recess. What must seem to them to be very extraneous business today. It's all quite important. And as an announcement to the committee, thank you. We will, we're waiting for a witness, and we will reopen our hearing on when Mr. Cooney arrives. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Lowell Bergen, a hearings officer with the PUC, and with me is Phil Schrader from the Attorney General's office, who will be here to respond to any questions you might have. The PUC is sponsoring this bill to close a loophole left by legislation passed in the 1987 session. In 1987, the legislature amended the Administrative Procedures Act, ORS 183.450 sub 7, to authorize agency staff to represent the agency at contested case hearings if the Attorney General has consented and if the agency approves the representation. Because ORS 183.450 does not apply to the PUC cannot be represented at contested case hearings by an employee. Passage of this bill will save some expense for attorney's fees. It will also improve the utilization of the Attorney General's services. Staff will be able to represent the agency in relatively minor cases, not requiring legal expertise. This legislation will put the PUC on the same footing as the agencies subject to the Administrative Procedures Act.
Thank you. Mr. Schrandl.
I have nothing further, Madam Chair. I have nothing further to add. I'm here simply to answer any questions that
the committee might have. Attorney General's office doesn't have any opposition to this bill.
No, in fact, we support it.
We in work session?
Well, we would like to go into work session if we had a quorum.
Maybe while we're waiting, I could ask him some questions.
Yes, Representative Edmondson.
Well, no, Madam Chair, I wasn't asking. I had some questions on another bill, but the Attorney General's office has shown up. I thought maybe I could ask him on this one. But I'll ask him.
Free legal advice.
Ask him privately. I just wondered how much they're charging in those tort claims.
Back to 2421. 100%
markup there, but I think I'll ask him out in the hall.
You don't have to answer any questions that you
now
don't want
to
answer.
Now we have a quorum.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either gentleman? We'll close the public hearing, thank you, and go into work session on Senate Bill 74. which the chair will move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? No discussion? Clerk will call the roll. I'll call the roll. Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Yes.
Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Minnis?
Aye.
And chair votes aye. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Cooney, we are back in public hearing on House Bill 2668.
My name is Tom Cooney. I'm an attorney from Portland. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, member of the Oregon Association Defense Council. I am here to speak in opposition of House Bill 2668. House Bill 2668 would greatly expand the existing statute of limitations as it relates to medical malpractice cases. The present law in Oregon on medical malpractice cases was enacted in 1975 because of special problems that were befalling the medical community and the availability of insurance because of cost and the problem of predicting how much premium to collect today in order to pay for claims that might come down the pike 5, 10, 15 years from now. One of the areas that we addressed at that time was the statute of limitations as to minors. At that time, and the current law is that a minor generally has 2 years from the date of discovery of the injury to bring the claim, and that is extended by a five-year disability or a five-year total period. In 1975, we made the statute of limitations for adults and minors in malpractice-type cases the same. 2 years from discovery, but no more than five from the date of the medical incident. The reason for that was twofold, primarily because of the difficulty in projecting long-term down-the-line expenses and lawsuits as to how much money to collect today for that. And insurance carriers were making insurance unavailable. At that time, the only insurance company in the state was withdrawing from coverage. So the 2 and 5 year was adopted at that point and has been the law ever since. There is an exception to that which gives the minor or an adult up to 10 years. And that exception is fraud or deceit by the physician, but there is the most important one is any misleading statement or representation by the physician as to the source or reason for the problem is sufficient to extend the statute of limitations. It does not have to be dishonestly made. It does not have to be done with intent to mislead. It can be a totally innocent statement. The doctor may think that the child's problem is colic when in fact it was something that was due to a birth defect.
Madam Chair, could I interrupt you for a minute? Mr. Cooney, Ms. Snyder testified quite explicitly, I thought, that in her view, the bill does not extend the statute of limitations for medical malpractice. At least I thought that's what she said. And I'm curious as to whether we have a disagreement as to what the bill does, or whether perhaps there's been an amendment offered that you were unaware of. I was confused.
Under the impression that these numbers included the medical malpractice statute. If they don't, do we have an ORS here right in front of me?
What section of statute would be?
Well, if this does not apply to medical malpractice, which I thought it did, and counsel says that it does not, then my statements are unnecessary. And I
thank you, Mr. Cooney.
Any lawyer that can be unnecessary is a good lawyer.
Nice recovery.
And so gracefully, Mr. Cooney.
No further questions.
Sometimes it helps to ask.
Yes, thank you for your question, Representative Clark. What I'm going to do, we are in the process of gathering a quorum. I'd like to ask if members would stick around. We're going to go into work session on House Bill 2668. Representative Mannix.
I move that we amend the bill. This is a conceptual amendment that would have to be drafted by legislative council, but the amendment would be to extend the statute of limitations to either the standard limitation which currently exists in any given, applicable to any given situation, or to extend it 5 years beyond the age of 18, whichever comes later, in causes of action brought by a child directly based on sexual, physical, or psychological abuse of the child.
That means that, let me accept the motion first. Thank you, Representative Mannix. And then I have a question. It's your intention that a child who is injured by intentional sexual molestation before the age of 5 could bring suit against the molester at the age of 23.
Yes. And that's based on not actually so much as testimony we've heard today, but testimony we heard when we were dealing in the Crime and Correction Subcommittee on sex abuse and physical abuse of children, that many of them, I can't say forget it, they black it out, they blank it out, and until they're into their adult years and some events occur, they become married and can't perform sexually in marriage. They run into difficulties in their adult lives, and they get counseling. And throughout that counseling, they suddenly become aware of prior events, or they were aware of them, and they were so fearful and so repressed that they would never reveal them. And, of course, it's still going to be a matter of proof in any given case. It's going to be up to the plaintiffs to be able to establish their case in a civil case by a preponderance of the evidence. My intention, though, is to open the door, but only in that limited kind of case, because not so much because we heard some lay testimony today, but in terms of the testimony we heard in front of the Crime and Correction Subcommittee, I'm satisfied that there's substantial evidence out there that these are the kinds of actions which are repressed or blacked out by individuals, and where there would be a proper social purpose served by saying we will extend the statute of limitations in those given cases and leave it up to the child to assert the cause of action.
Thank you.
Now, may I
just wanted to make sure it certainly addresses the circumstances which have been brought to the committee's attention today. Go ahead, add one more thing.
Representative Minnis raised a concern about psychological abuse, and that could be a pretty broad term. I thought about that some more after you mentioned that to me, and we are dealing with what I'd call actionable abuse, and as I thought about it, I thought, well, it's still a matter of proof, and one is going to have to prove that this was actionable abuse. Even though we use the term psychological, it's going to have to be some sort of tortious conduct.
Intentional infliction.
Representative Edmondson.
Intentional infliction.
And that my intention would be to relate to that kind of concept and not open up a new. We're not trying to create new causes of action. We're simply dealing with the statute of limitation for existing causes of action.
Thank you. That's real clear.
Me.
Other questions, comments?
I guess I have to ask a question in terms of intent. Would this, in terms of your amendments, deal with a child who decides to sue their parents because of what they consider to be deep psychological problems or actions? I'm not sure what the exact words were relevant to religious beliefs or religious practices because of the faith of the parents and the upbringing of the children.
Only to the extent that they currently could do so. I want to be clear about that because I wouldn't want to open up new causes of action. But if there were actionable conduct right now, I would just say if it's actionable at the age of 19, it should also be actionable at the age of 23. Or if it was actionable now at the age of 9 through a guardian ad litem, that it could be actionable up to the age of 23. But I want to be clear that I'm not trying to create any new causes of action, just allowing this extension of the statute of limitations. So if there are such lawsuits, and I'm cautious about that because I'd be concerned about those kinds of lawsuits, and I'm not creating any new law in that area, or at least this amended bill is not intended to do that.
Other questions?
I appreciate Representative Menace's question because that's what it wouldn't necessarily need to be limited to the question of religious upbringing. I mean, there are bad parenting lawsuits happening all over the country, and there's difference in my view between child abuse and bad parenting.
But may I inquire?
Well, one would hope, anyway.
I guess the concern is, yes, I would hope so, too, although I imagine in some cases it could be pretty close. I guess the concern, and Representative Maddox has stated this very clearly, is that he is not intending to create any new cause of action. And I think Ms. Snyder's statements into the record are also very clear that the circumstance that is questionable, I suppose, where evidence has gotten extremely old or stale or is difficult to find, is a decision which the attorney and the attorney's client will have to make when they are considering the likelihood of prevailing in the lawsuit.
Could I get Representative Maddox to read his suggested conceptual amendment again?
This would be to amend the bill to simply extend the statute of limitations to either the standard limitation, which currently applies, or 5 years beyond the age of 18, whichever comes later, in causes of action brought by a child directly based on sexual, physical, or psychological abuse of the child.
Okay. I would be, speaking for myself, would be more comfortable if, I don't know what psychological abuse is, and I don't know how one goes about proving that. I don't know what those cases look like today under existing law. I don't know.
More comfortable if we just said directly relating to abuse of the child?
I would be.
I would accept that. I'd also be open
to Ms. Snyder's thoughts on this point, Madam Chair, if we could get...
Do you want to come up here, Judy?
I just want to be clear what we're doing.
Actually, if we could, before you make your comments, if I could ask that Representative Maddox make the purpose of his amendment from the proposed original clear on the record, that might be helpful so that we can at least direct ourselves toward Representative Maddox's purpose.
My first purpose is to focus again only on statutes of limitations, not creating any new causes of action. Second of all, to take a bill which right now has what I'll say has a shotgun cause of action possibility that opens up a very broad door to lots of kinds of causes of action in terms of extending statutes of limitation, to focus on a particular problem that's been presented to us, which is sexual abuse of a child or physical abuse of a child. And I didn't want to totally leave out, there may be situations of what I'll call psychological torture, for example, where a child may have been scarred mentally but may have no physical abuse whatsoever, where if there's presently a cause of action that I would intend to extend the cause of action to some 5 years into beyond the age of majority to allow that person some time of recuperation and reconciliation and then recognition of the circumstances, and then still have an opportunity to seek civil damages.
Thank you.
And I guess my question for Ms. Snyder would be, what's the current cause of action for what Representative Maddox has referred to as psychological abuse? I mean, someone comes to you and says that either this is my child and I want to bring an action on behalf of my child against some teacher who has engaged in serious psychological abuse, and they go through this scenario, and it's horrible stuff, or a child reaches the age of majority and wants to sue his or her parents for that kind of thing, and maybe it's in addition to physical abuse. So, I mean, there's clearly a bad situation going on here. I'm not playing devil's advocate. I just want to know, what's the cause of action today?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, this always makes me feel like I'm taking a bar exam, so let me work this one out. There is a cause of action in Oregon for intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's premise number one. There is a cause of action for negligent infliction if it is combined with actual physical injury. So if you don't have physical injury, forget about your unintentional but nevertheless psychological injuries. There's a third cause of action which is more difficult to prove, and that's the outrageous conduct sort of case. It's the oh my God, where the conduct is so outrageous in the extreme that the courts have said we will give psychological damages for this type of recovery. The run-of-the-mill case is where you have physical injury and psychological emotional damages as a result of that. That's the run-of-the-mill case. Less frequently do you see intentional infliction of emotional distress. Less frequently do you see outrageous conduct.
Under the existing
statute... Representative Clark.
I'm sorry. Under the existing statute of limitations, can a person sue his or her parents for intentional infliction of emotional distress?
I don't know.
Okay.
Well, in your experience, do you have clients coming to you seeking to sue their parents for intentional infliction of emotional distress?
Madam Chair, in all candor, I have not, and I know I don't speak for all the plaintiff's attorneys in the state of Oregon in that assessment, but what we generally find, and I'm being general and very generic, usually the abuse, not always, but usually it's a step parent. But it's not unheard of for it to be a natural parent.
Do you suppose Representative Mannix has a friendly amendment that you could omit the word psychological damage, those words from your amendment?
In fact, would you like it just directly based on abuse of the child and leave it at that?
No, Madam Chair,
go ahead.
When I drafted this bill, legislative counsel took out my words physical and sexual abuse and substituted assault and battery. Apparently, they found that physical and sexual abuse was too nonspecific and instead drafted it as assault and battery. I'm not comfortable enough with the legislative process to understand why that occurred or if that is a necessary amendment. I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Fortunately, I'm sorry. May I comment?
Yes, go
theirs
ahead,
is not the will of God, nor is theirs the word of God, and many of us have learned that, and, particularly on this committee, which has about 10 out of 12 members are lawyers, and so we don't necessarily admit that other lawyers know better than we do, although they may well.
Other comments, questions for Ms. Snyder?
Do you prefer to see sexual, I'm sorry, may I ask that question?
Go ahead.
Would you prefer to see sexual and physical abuse in there? As opposed to assault and battery, which to me is an old-fashioned term that doesn't really fit in the Oregon system anymore.
Of course, Representative Mannix, attorneys make terrible clients, and I think we've been put on notice what the advice of our attorneys is.
But you would prefer?
I'd like to give it further thought. I quite frankly accept it at face value, Madam Chair, the wisdom of legislative counsel in making this proposal. I believe that physical and sexual abuse is significantly defined, at least by the body of criminal case law that has evolved around those issues, that I know it when I see it, and I believe I could plead it and prove it under those circumstances, certainly with more impact than saying this is an assault and battery and trying to explain what that concept means to a jury.
Representative Minnis.
Ms. Snyder, in 1985, we amended the definition of child abuse in Oregon to include psychological abuse, and I don't know whether you're aware.
Yes.
But the question I have is whether there have been any appellate court cases in Oregon that have served to define psychological abuse